There's been some hard feelings here about some words that were said, and some hard feelings here, and what's more, there's been a bloody purple and some bloody purple that were messing up the law. It's just apartment house rules. So all your apartment house fools, remember one man's ceiling is another man's floor. One man's ceiling is another man's floor. There's been some strange goings on, and some folks have come and gone, like the air. Another man's floor, I tell you. One man's ceiling is another man's floor.
Hi, this is your host, Gareth Rice, and you're listening to Canadiana Suite on UMFM 101.5 radio station. This is a radio program primarily dedicated to highlighting the works of the many talented Canadian jazz artists on the scene today. You just heard Aaron Shore's socially distanced cover of Paul Simon's One Man's Ceiling is Another Man's Floor, featured as part of his concert series Still Crazy, the Music of Paul Simon. He's a local guitarist from Winnipeg who studied with Peter Bernstein, Miles Okazaki, and Jonathan Kreisberg, and he's now the new jazz guitar teacher at U of M. Before the interview, we'll check out Deacon Blues from Steely Dan's legendary Grammy-winning 1977 album, Aja.
Call me a fool, you say it's a crazy scheme.
Joining us is Aaron Shore, a local guitarist from Winnipeg. He studied at Humber College and U of M, and he's also had private instruction from the likes of Peter Bernstein, Jonathan Kreisberg, and Miles Okazaki. He takes influence from soul, funk, folk, and the classic guitar trio setup, which will all be showcased at his upcoming jazz festival performance on June 16th, entitled Still Crazy, The Music of Paul Simon. How are you doing, Aaron?
Good. I have to add that that's actually a bio for a jazz, actual jazz guitar gig I did with the festival, I think a few years ago.
Right, with Sheena Rakan, right?
No, it would have been with, I think probably trio with Julian and Kevin Waters or something like that.
Yeah.
So the Still Crazy thing is actually, it's not really a jazz thing. It's a separate sort of project in that respect. So, yeah.
But it's kind of, an adjacent thing that's part of the festival.
It's adjacent. I mean, and that music is it's so influenced, especially sort of the middle part of his catalog is so influenced by jazz. It's really hard to avoid. And he had so many jazz musicians on his records back then, Michael Brecker, Phil Woods.
Yeah.
Adam Rogers played with Paul Simon. Bill Frisell played with Paul Simon. Who else? Steve Gadd, of course. And his music has always been a big part of, it's always been a big part of my life. Prior to getting into jazz, while getting into jazz, while getting out of jazz, while getting back into jazz,
Yeah, I guess so. It was kind of a natural approach for you to just adapt the music and find some arrangements and just start the project.
There wasn't a lot of adapting to happen, honestly. When we started it, we put this show together about 3 years ago in 2018. I think it was 2018. I tried to just learn the music, write the music out as it wasn't, as close as I could to get on the records, because I didn't feel like I really had to do much with it. I'm always kind of a believer in just learn the music first.
Yeah.
And, go from there. Don't try to go reinvent it right off the hop. I'm like that as a jazz musician as well. Whether I'm playing someone's book, in a tribute setting, this Paul Simon thing, first I just want to learn the songs, and I also want to learn my parts, which is a different kind of gear from being a jazz musician.
Definitely, yeah.
But then even in jazz, I'm I don't want to have to come up with some arrangement right off the hop. First, I just want to learn the music. And if something presents itself that would be interesting as an arrangement, I'll go for it. But it's not always an immediate priority. In fact, it's often not an immediate priority, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's kind of like if the music reveals itself through the process.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's some things in the show that I've changed some things and done some arrangements a little differently. Usually it's something as simple as okay, maybe this tune is really just a great guitar and voice duo. There's a couple tunes in the set that Sheena and I just do duo, and they work great. And otherwise there would be a band, or the arrangement's just a little bit different. But otherwise, it's really just get the two, use, it's like present the song is what is most important, and give the song whatever it needs to, to be understood and to be heard.
Yeah, and then just in relation to the set as well, and just have that balance.
Yeah, I really enjoy just set planning. It's fun. It's really, really fun. It's a puzzle. If you're set planning for jazz, I just try to get a nice either something to get everyone's attention right away, and then a ballad to sort of cleanse the palate, a straight eighth tune to a tune in three, an original, a pop tune, reworks, and then y'all might kind of think that way. In this setting, it's okay, well, again, do I want to try to pull everyone in right away, or do we want to try to like bring them in gradually? So it's different. And it's like, okay, well, there's got to be some ballads. There's got to be some up-tempo tunes. And then, okay, this tune, we don't want two tunes in the same key right next to each other unless it works for a specific reason. You know, I got to change between this guitar and that guitar, and we don't want too much time in between tunes. So this tune can't go before that tune, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah. It's kind of the same thing with the radio show as well, just like planning sets.
Yeah, it's very, it's fun. It's actually, it's always, to me, it's always a puzzle.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, music Tetris or something.
Yeah, and a kind of a formula I tried to sort of figure out when doing this, especially if it's, if you're dealing with music that people know, then it's that sort of its own like challenge.
Yeah.
Because there's stuff that they're sort of expecting to hear, and you know that most of the music they're going to know or they're going to recognize. So it's first like earn their trust, test their trust, like take them somewhere they don't really expect to go, maybe play a tune that they don't really know, something in Paul Simon's book that they don't know as well. There's a couple of those in this set. And then reward it, you know, play something that they all really, really, really know. Like I remember seeing McCartney a number of years ago. I saw him in Chicago. I'm a huge Paul McCartney and Beatles fan. Like, always have been. And he played, he has all of his hits. Like he has, goes through all these Beatles and Wings tunes. And then it was like two tunes in a row, which were like new Paul McCartney tunes that no one knew, no one cared. They, like everyone got up and like, it's really cool to hear them, but like people were not there for that. And then it's like right after that, he played like Hey Jude or something, like some mega, like mega hit. Like he knew what to do. He knew how to work with that part of the, you know, the set. I find that neat.
Yeah.
I used to nerd out on like setlist.com and like.
Setlist.com?
Yeah, there's a, I think it's setlist.com, but it's like, yeah, you can, I mean, this is more for, I don't think you'd find it as much stuff for like jazz artists.
Right.
But it's like any pop, any like even remotely medium to large scale touring act, it goes as deep as like the 80s. It's like, you know, what was Queen set in Seattle in like 1982? You could find it, like,
wow.
You know, I don't know if that's exactly, if like I kind of just made that up, but you know, you could go, it's really fun, actually, it's cool. You know, what was Springsteen set in Vancouver in, you know, 93 or something? You could find it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's setlist.com, but if you just like, you can find it.
Yeah. I also saw that you did some like pretty extensive research as well. Like you read like interviews, biographies, and like you like flew to New York for like Madison Square, like the Paul Simon thing. So how do those like, in, how does that inform your approach to the project and like, I guess your appreciation of Paul Simon?
I kind of just, it helped me. I read there's two biographies, Paul Simon, A Life. I read, which is like the Paul Simon biography that he's okay with everyone reading. He's kind of a pretty, he's a pretty private person. So and then I read another biography. I mean, they kind of, most of them hit through most of the same parts of his career, but it was one thing that was really, really interesting about him was that I found that the way that he writes is almost backwards compared to the way that so many of my other favorite songwriters write. Like, you know, I'm talking less from a jazz point of view right now, but like my favorite songwriters, like, you know, Stevie Wonder or Donald Fagen or Paul McCartney, like these kinds of writers, or Joni Mitchell, it's like they get a melody, they start writing words, you know, that harmony kind of comes in sort of at the same, the way that they're working at the harmony and the form kind of happens roughly at the same time. where it's like Paul Simon, there's like a really specific order every time. It was like he'd have a groove in his head.
Yeah.
A melody would emerge in the groove. He'd write like a complete melody and harmony underneath that melody, and then the words. Like the lyrics came last. Which I found was very interesting. And like so much of his music, I'm not sure. Have you checked out much of Paul Simon's music?
Yeah, I checked out like Still Crazy After All These Years and like some Simon and Garfunkel stuff. Yeah.
I mean, Still Crazy After All These Years is an amazing example of like, well, it's jazz harmony, like really, really good jazz harmony, a really singable melody. And he goes through like three modulations.
Right.
Like throughout, and you don't even notice until you like lift it, like until you actually start learning the tune.
Yeah, if you're so fluid.
It's so fluid. You don't even notice. And another tune that he does that is like One Man's Ceiling is Another Man's Floor.
Yeah.
Where it like modulate, which is like actually kind of, it's like what's going on in the harmony is parallel with the subject matter of the song. Like it modulates up a fourth every time it passes.
Yeah.
And, it's so effortless. And it's like, if you were to ask who wrote, like, if you were just to show someone the harmony of these tunes, you'd be like, well, who do you think wrote this? Do you think a folk singer wrote this? Or do you think like, you know, Gershwin or Cole Porter or like, you know, Rodgers and Hemp, like did they write that? You'd think it was like a Tin Pan Alley tune or something, you know? Yeah, both of those songs are like that. And on those two records, I sort of found that he's, if I'm talking Paul Simon post Simon and Garfunkel, I sort of learned that he had like pairs of records. Like there's the Paul Simon songbook, and then There Goes Ryman Simon. Oh no, Paul Simon songbook, which is his first one. There Goes Ryman Simon, which has like, There Goes Ryman Simon has songs like Kodachrome, One Man's Ceiling. What else is on that? Something So Right. American Tune, which is like that American Tune is based on a Bach chorale. It's like a specific Bach. I can't remember which one. I used to know. And then Still Crazy After All These Years. And then there's like a couple records after that. And all three of those first records sort of have like a really like specific kind of vibe or feeling. And it's just like through each record, it's a little bit more refined, like from Songbook to Still Crazy After All These Years. It's kind of the same. The songs are kind of similar, but it's like they're just a little bit more refined on each record. And then he's like, okay, well, I'll throw that away. Like throw that away. And then he made Hearts and Bones and One Trick Pony, which are kind of like rock. I don't know what to categorize them exactly, but it's like a lot of like acoustic and chorusy guitar, like very like 80s kind of what now what we call like really dated, like, you know, sounds that people are not into using anymore. And those records, like those two records, have a very uniform sound between the two of them. And then it's like Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints. Those two records, the songs are really similar. I mean, one is made with musicians from South Africa. The other one is made with a combination of music. Rhythm of the Saints is musicians from South Africa and also like Brazilian Carnival.
Yeah.
I mean, he got a lot of some sort of rightful criticism for the way that he made those records. The songs are fantastic, but if you want to look at it from there's a bit of an appropriation that happens there that not everyone's okay with. And I think a lot of the criticism he received in that respect could be justified. But the songs are wonderful. They're still really, really great songs. And then all the records, well, no. And then he made Songs from the Cape Man, which is brutal. Don't ever listen to that. It's really bad. And then all the records he released since then, all like still, I think it's called You're the One, up until the last one he released, which I think was So Beautiful or So What? I think it was that one. Those have like a specific thing. Like they all have a sound that's pretty uniform. Like,
yeah.
And then when I saw them, it was really just hearing how the arrangements were. Like when I saw him, he had just released a record with sort of like redos of older tunes of his that did not really get a lot of play, or they were just... Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, sorry about that. Sorry about that.
That's fine.
My headphones just stopped working. And when I saw him, he was playing with this group, Y Music. I don't know if you're hip to Y Music.
Never heard of it, actually.
They're amazing. They're like a New York chamber group. And they play a lot of, they work with a lot of like pop and rock musicians, but the arrangements that they play are really, really amazing. And the playing is at like a super high level. So they were playing on Paul Simon's last record that he made, In the Blue Light. They've done stuff with Tallest Man on Earth, stuff with Bon Iver, stuff with, I think they did stuff with Bruce Hornsby. They're great. And they were on that whole tour that I saw Paul Simon. They're on that entire tour.
Yeah.
So he did, like, they serve partly as like his horn section, but they also, he did like three tunes, which was just him in the chamber group, of like really great chamber music arrangements of like Bridge Over Troubled Water, Renee and George Edmund Greet, which is also on the record. I can't remember what else, but it was wonderful. So it was neat just seeing him like work in his present, sort of what his present mode was at that time, which was actually when I saw him though, that was when he got, that was like his last kick at actually touring and being on the road. So he still performs, he just doesn't tour anymore.
Yeah.
He doesn't do the long tours. So yeah. Sorry for the long convoluted answer.
No, it's fine. It was interesting just hearing all the your different kind of takes on the albums and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess going off of like that, what you said initially about like just taking a bunch of influences from different things. Like, I know you're a huge like Steely Dan fan, and like you post a bunch of like really interesting, like kind of underrated albums on Facebook sometimes. So it's kind of curious as to like how like all your influences have kind of like developed to form like your own unique sound, I guess.
Oh, that's a good question. I've always been really drawn to just good writing. Like, I don't do a heck of a lot of writing of my own, but, just really good songwriting, and Steely Dan is one place where I always really found that, like such great hooks that they write. The harmony is great, the grooves are amazing, and the lyrics are just like these hilariously quirky, like and also on top of that, the guitar player, it's really fun guitar music. Like, there's always great guitar solos, great guitar, like rhythm guitar parts, really interesting harmony that's fun to play on guitar.
Yeah.
And for me, Steely Dan, stuff like Steely Dan, it always kind of fits in the same, like, it's the same but separate from like all the music that I like, from like, you know, Weather Report through like Matheny Group. I love Matheny Group.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that stuff. I think some people give it an unfair bad rap. I think that the great Matheny Group stuff is like some of the best music ever.
Oh yeah. Matheny Group. Like, I got into it last year. It's so
cool. Yeah. Yeah. Like, you know, have you listened to Travels?
Yeah.
Travels and First Circle and Watercolors.
Oh, First Circle. Yeah. It's a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
First Circle is so good. Yeah. I mean, and I always kind of felt like what I got from Steely Dan was pretty similar to what I get from that music, just I've always just been, to me, I've always just enjoyed learning really good music and learning to play it, and then learning the tunes and learning to play on them. And it's the same for, like, you know, learning Beatles songs or learning like Simon and Garfunkel or Paul Simon songs.
to me, it still sort of is one big music.
Yeah.
You know, in addition to learning like Wayne tunes and Joe Henderson tunes and Herbie tunes. And I mean, it's a, when you're playing like pop music, it's a different gear to be in. It's a slower gear and you're playing. You have to learn more to like play a part and to service the song itself.
Yeah.
But to me, it's still, I still learn so much about how music works, regardless of what sort of genre that music is coming from.
Yeah, definitely.
The gear that I have to put myself in to play it is different, but
yeah, because like I guess kind of genre kind of gets like a bad rap, or like oh, that's not real music. Like if you like, I guess if you're like a jazz head, it's like, oh, why are you playing pop music? But it's like they're all the same thing at the end of the day. It's just a different like way of playing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some classification with music is always fair.
Yeah,
because you can still have to have kind of an idea of what it is.
Right.
And every music that we play comes from some sort of social culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's informed by that social culture from which it comes from, and vice versa. It also informs that social culture. And sometimes I think casting too wide of a net over what a certain kind of music is not helpful, but it can also sort of be the other way. Like, you know, if we talk about jazz, for example, I always try to think that not all improvised music is jazz, and not all jazz is improvised music.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kind of.
Yeah. Like it kind of has to come from, it still has to be informed by the tradition.
Right.
And by bebop and swing. Like, you know, if you look at any amazing, like, if I just look at the guitar players I love, like John Scofield or Pat Metheny, they can be playing, John Scofield could be playing like the funkiest stuff ever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still playing bebop. Like he's still coming from that. Like, same thing with Pat. If Pat is playing like, you know, these super long, like multi-section heavy orchestrations from like, you know, the Metheny group.
Yeah.
It's still, he's the lines and the stuff that he's still playing still comes from bebop. Like it's, you can't pretend that it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the neat thing about jazz musicians too is like they could, I'm not speaking for myself, I'm not saying that I'm at this level, but it's like a really good jazz musician could go play with like the New York Philharmonic and probably not get fired and then go play with like, you know, Jay-Z or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably not get fired.
That would be a bonus. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess going off of the jazz guitar thing, you studied with Peter Bernstein and like the two others I'm not familiar with, like Jonathan Kreisberg and Miles Okazaki. So like, what was that experience like? Because I talked with Mike Rudd and he kind of played with Peter Bernstein. And he said like, it's quite interesting.
Well, I should maybe add a caveat to that part of my resume. I took one lesson with Peter Bernstein. So, I mean, years ago, and it was Keith Price. Do you know Keith Price?
Yeah, I know the name.
Yeah. Yeah, him and myself were in New York when we were both in our early 20s, and we got a lesson with Pete together. Like, nice. We kind of went and we played together for Pete. And I kind of just remember Pete saying, like, dude, you got to make sure you're really, like, conveying the time. Like, you're really conveying it. And I played a standard. I can't remember what the standard was. And he's like, you don't really know the chord changes. You just know the chord changes from the book. It's like you have to actually really know the harmony of how the tune works. And then I can't remember what it was. We played like, I'll just say it was Stella. I don't know what the tune was. And he said something really funny, like, you got to play it really slow, like pretend that your grandparents are dancing and that you really got to make them dance. And that really stuck out. But I took, I think, about almost a dozen lessons with Miles Okazaki and Jonathan Kreisberg. They're very different guitar players. Like, so, so, so different. Miles Okazaki was just someone who is just so... he's kind of just a master of rhythm who happens to play the guitar. That's kind of what he is. And he's also just got such a mega, like, huge mind. And even though, like, Miles Okazaki does all this crazy stuff, he writes these books that are super in-depth, and he writes this music that's super super hard and crazy, and he still is like, it's like, you know, learn Charlie Christian solos and let's work on the feel, like, let's work on, like, you know, playing it's like, just let's just make sure that we have a really, really good understanding of how harmony and how rhythm works.
Yeah.
And that would kind of be it. Like, don't worry about trying to do all the, like, making all these grand gestures. It's like, still just work on the fundamental things that you really, really need to work on. And he would be extremely thorough in that regard. Honestly, Jonathan Kreisberg was very similar too, but he was like, his big thing was like, really work on how bebop language works. Like, he was really serious about making sure that you can play chord tones on downbeats, that you know, are able to sort of construct, like, I always said, like, Jonathan Kreisberg was able to, like, just construct, like, perfect bebop phrases that, like, could fit behind museum glass, like, if you wrote them out, and he works them all out, and he can play them at basically any tempo in any key. They're like, it was really neat to study with the two of them because they were just very, it's like, if we think of the two Sonnies, like
Sonny Rollins, Sonny Clark.
I was going to say Sonny Rollins and Sonny Stitt. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Jonathan Kreisberg was like Sonny Stitt, where it's like all this perfect bebop all the time, where like every note is perfectly executed, it's perfectly in time. But then Sonny Rollins, that's like Jonathan Kreisberg. Miles Okazaki was more like Sonny Rollins, where it's like constant improvising, like playing from the melody, asking yourself questions and answering them, like, and like really reaching. So, and I always sort of felt like, okay, I think I'd like to be somewhere in between these two, like, extremes. And I just happened to get that stuff from two different guitar players. I mean, I feel like I probably could have got that information from a whole whack of musicians. It's just because I play the guitar, that's who I got it from. So,
yeah. Makes sense in a kind of weird way, I guess. Yeah. The whole guitar thing, you know, just a passing instrument just happened.
Yeah, it's just, it's like, well, this is just the, it's like, this is the physical interface we're using to, you know.
To
play bebop.
Yeah. It kind of links back to what you were saying about, like, Pat Metheny, like still checking out, like, Charlie Parker and stuff.
Like, yeah. John
Scofield. Yeah. So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. I went through a major John Scofield tear recently.
Nice.
I was checking out a bunch of records from a bunch of different periods. I was checking out, there's a DVD. I mean, that's like, there's a DVD a while back where he's playing in an organ trio with Don Pollan and Marvin Smitty Smith. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
No.
It's awesome. I recommend checking it out. And he's like just playing bebop language like an absolute mofo, but like with distortion and like bending notes. Then I was also checking out some of his like 80s, some of the 80s records, like Loud and Blue Matter. Blue Matter is one of my favorite Skull records. I don't know if you've checked that one out.
Oh, yeah, I've checked it out. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's great. It's really, really great. And be like, oh man, these tunes are completely different.
Right.
Like from one year to the next, but he still sounds the same. Like, and the language that he's playing, it's like in the 80s records, he's playing a bit more like rock guitar, like a bit more like pentatonic, like really guitaristic type of stuff. But it's like, it's still bebop. He's still doing that. It just happens to be with like a 16th note groove and some slap bass and, I'm trying to, there's a specific keyboard sound that's on a bunch of that stuff. It's like a sound that Jay Graydon, you know, the 80s keyboard sound.
Yeah.
There's a really specific one. But I get as much joy out of listening to that as I do anything else. You know, John Coltrane sound, or, you know, Juju, or, you know, Tchaikovsky or something.
Yeah. It's all connected.
It's all connected. For me, it's all connected.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, you talked about all those like guitar players and like how they've influenced you. So I'm kind of curious, like, how have you kind of found that middle ground with your own like guitar teaching philosophy when you teach students?
That's a good question. Well, I kind of find that I try to, depending on the student I'm working with, I try to first just sort of meet them where they are.
Yeah.
And work out from there. Like, first it's like, one thing that I could take a lot from like someone like Matheny or Jonathan Kreisberg or Miles, for that matter, it's like making sure that certain fundamentals are like kind of non-negotiable. Like, it's like be able to play major scales in all 12 keys in one position on the neck and around the neck and with good time and like things like that and good technique. But in terms of material, like, I really still just try to, like, if the student is like not really had a lot of exposure to jazz, but they, you know, they kind of want to learn it, I really just try to give them the same kind of stuff that almost any, you know, jazz teacher is probably going to give their students. Like, it's, you know, like, learn a couple Wynton Cali solos, like learn the Wynton Cali solo on Freddie Freeloader. Just learn to play that, and like, I'll help you work out fingerings if you need to and understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of just showing them what I'm into and trying to, cause like every student is going to, they're all going to discover different things at different parts in their like journey.
Yeah.
So it's not my job to shove like all of my favorite stuff down their throat. I don't think that's really productive.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're going to find it. Like, I might show, I'm totally happy to show them stuff and them. And if they really like it, then, you know, go for it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if I have a guitar student who like is really into like Grant Green and Barney Kessel and like, that's awesome, then yeah, do that. You know, let me, I'm just like, I don't necessarily play like that, but let me at least try to help you get a lot closer to that.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like someone is into Alan Holdsworth and, you know, Steely Dan and 80s Sco. It's like, well, that's also awesome. Some of that stuff I physically cannot play, but I will still kind of help you get there, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I had a teacher, actually, he's around my age. He's one of Fabio's friends, Alex Goodman. Do you know Alex Goodman?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've heard of him.
Yeah. I took some lessons with him last year for a little while, and he just made a really good point. It's like, just try to get as good at the instrument as you possibly can and look for the stuff that resonates within you.
Yeah.
Like, and develop it and show it to the world, like, and go from there. And I think that's kind of true for everyone. Like, don't be worried about what you like versus what other people like. And just sort of use that as a model for what, you know, what kind of aesthetic is interesting to you and like what you want to do. And like, that's why I find it so neat. Like, if I just talk about the guitar, that there's guys like Kurt Rosenwinkel, and then there's also guys like Bill Frisell.
Right.
You know, I love Bill Frisell. And then there's guys like Adam Rogers can kind of do everything. Like, he's kind of one of the few like true chameleon guitar players. Like, he can play, you know, with Michael Brecker. He's like, he did a couple tours. Do you know that record, Time Is of the Essence?
I do not. I should
check that's it a out. Great, it's Michael Brecker, Matheny, Larry Goldings, and Tane.
Oh, nice.
I think. And Elvin Jones and Bill Stewart. There's three drummers on the record. So it's like Adam Rogers could tour with them.
Yeah.
And then he can do his own like power trio of like Hendrix stuff. And then he can, now he's like, has like the rhythm guitar chair in Steely Dan.
Yeah.
He's doing that. So it's like, he's one of the few guys that can do like all of these different things. But it's like every one of those musicians I may have mentioned, they'd have like a different, a similar, but maybe different enough, like set of music that really, really grabbed them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
And they just,
and it's just sort of working from wherever you found that music.
Yeah, definitely.
You know. Anyways, that's just my that's just me stroking my ego on his trying to sound smart.
Well, we have to try sometime. I'm not gonna make a Star Wars reference. That'd be too cringe.
Yeah.
I guess do you have any future gigs or any future projects coming up?
In the immediate future, no. Just what I'm playing with, I guess list my Jazz Fest itinerary. I'm playing with Rosemary Galloway on Tuesday. On Wednesday, I'm playing with Soul James, my great friend Hay the Forsyth, Amber Epp, who I've known just about as long as Hay the. I'm playing sort of back to back, two different venues.
Yeah.
On Wednesday, and then I'm double gigging on Thursday too, doing the Paul Simon show at the King's Head. And then right after in the same venue, I'm playing with Sheena Ratai. And then Sunday at the Cube, I'm playing with 8-Bit and the Single Players.
Oh, right. Yeah.
The video game music, which is really fun. I'm like such a cool project. I mean, they're all great projects, but the video game music, the 8-Bit and the Single Players in particular is just so cool because it's just like, never been done in town. Like no one in town has ever like, you know, try to crack that egg. And Ben has done such an amazing job.
Yeah, I checked out that album. Like I know him from like that his YouTube channel where he like analyzes video game music theory.
Yeah.
Like, that record is like so killing. Like,
yeah.
The arrangements that he did and
yeah. I'm not a hit. Like there's some games I like. I play some games. I've played some video games in my life, but I've never been like a deep gamer.
Yeah.
So I didn't know any of the music, like none of it. It was all of that. I'd never heard any of that music before in my life, which is also kind of a fun way to play it. There was no preconceived like idea of how that music was supposed to sound. I mean, I knew a little bit, like I knew what Rainbow Road and I knew, you know, a little bit of the Mario Kart stuff, but
yeah. Yeah, I guess you had to like record the like Super Smash Bros. Melee thing, didn't you? Like there was like a voice thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And yeah, we did that. And like it was like a 2-bar, like really fast. And it's like the GameCube intro. Yeah, the GameCube intro.
Yeah, Carter was saying that was really hard to like nail down.
It was really hard. It was, we all got our butts kicked in that session. We recorded over 2 days. We did 2 days in the studio and then a third day of fixes. And the fixes took the whole day. You know, our studio chops were not, so I don't want to say our, my studio chops were a little rusty. Because, you know, I hadn't really done much studio stuff in a few years, especially through COVID. So,
yeah, COVID or.
And it was like a heavy read. He totally got my butt kicked, but he was so fun. So fun.
Yeah, sounded like that. Yeah. I guess is your cat going to be joining you on the gig? Because it seems like your cat is quite the caterwauling speaker phone.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wish he could, but he's never left the house.
Oh, well, I guess you're gonna have to coax him out.
Yeah, I have to coax him out. Yeah.
Maybe with like a sponsorship to Bon Me King or something.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's my other like, I think I've like kept them open, Bon Me King, for the last 2 years. I order too much from there. But, you know, while I'm out here, there's like, I'm just eating fish like every single day.
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah, every day. It's amazing. I don't know if you've ever been out to this part of Canada.
Newfoundland? No.
No, I recommend it. It's really fun. It's just the people are just so friendly. There's fresh fish everywhere. It's a small town. Like St. John's is like about 140,000 people or something who like all want to be your best friend.
Nice.
It's just such a nice place.
Thanks to Aaron Shore for being here on the show. What you heard before the interview was his cover of One Man's Ceiling is Another Man's Floor by Paul Simon and Deacon Blues from Steely Dan's Aja. We'll end it off with Pat Martino's original called The Visit from 1975's Footprints and the 63 duo record Kenny Burrell and John Coltrane playing When Was I Born from Kern and Hammerstein. This is Canadiana Suite signing off. Thank you.
Thank you.